from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. After disappointing supporters with his performance in the first presidential debate, President Obama went on the offensive against Mitt Romney in last night's debate at Hofstra University in New York.
Governor Romney says he's got a five-point plan. Governor Romney doesn't have a five-point plan. He has a one-point plan.
But Romney continued to hammer home his message about the president's record on jobs and the economy.
When we're talking about math that doesn't add up, how about $4 trillion of deficits? Over the last 4 years, $5 trillion. That's math that doesn't add up.
Join us for in-depth analysis from a roundtable of veteran political analysts as we deconstruct last night's debate. Forum is up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And in this morning's opening Forum Hour, we get reaction and analysis to last night's debate between Democratic President Barack Obama and his Republican challenger, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. It was the second of three presidential debates designed to be a town hall format at Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, with CNN's Candy Crowley moderating and undecided voters assembled by Gallup asking the questions. The debate, with high stakes based on President Obama's need to come back from what many perceived to have been a clear victory by his opponent Mitt Romney in the first debate, turned contentious and argumentative, even hostile early on. This morning's opening hour, we deconstruct last night's debate and have three veteran analysts with us. We want to welcome first Ron Elving, who is senior Washington editor for NPR News and joins us from the nation's capital. Welcome, Ron.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Good to have you with us. And also good to have Lisa Lehrer with us, reporter for Bloomberg News, who is with the Romney campaign and with us from New York City. Welcome, Lisa Lehrer.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Larry Gersten, who is professor in the Department of Political Science at San Jose State University. And welcome, Larry Gersten.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for being here. And Ron Elving, I'm going to begin with you. In your blog earlier this week, you said that the president can recover if he punches back without being petulant and tough without being unpresidential. Did he do that?
I believe that on balance he did. I think the town hall format, which was supposed to be a problem for him, did not in the end prevent him from being as fired up and ready to go as he wanted to be in this second debate. As you said earlier, the first one cost him dearly. In fact, that first debate in Denver still looms over this campaign and will until we see what effect might come out of this debate and perhaps the third debate next week. Because up until then, the race had a certain shape. The race had a certain character in the polls. People had a certain attitude towards the two candidates. And since that first debate in Denver, that has changed at the margin. And of course, it's at the margin that the election is decided.
There was rancor, as I also mentioned in my introduction. It turned into, in many people's judgment, a kind of an alpha male contest, and all these sports metaphors have been flying around, and so have, prognostications about the results or what they mean. President Obama actually prepping 12 hours a day to come back from what had been characterized as a disengaged and listless performance in Denver. Was there a clean winner, or are we a loser? Are we talking about a split decision as you see it, Ron?
I see it as a split decision that was a great deal more important to the president than it was to his challenger. In this case, both parties had something to cheer, and in that sense, of course, the contrast to the first debate clearly favors the president. But that doesn't mean that Mitt Romney went away. And given the change in the dynamic of the campaign in the month of October, all Mitt Romney needed to do was consolidate some of the gains that he's made and keep this race as competitive as he has made it and continue to make the case that we really don't know what another 4 years of Barack Obama would be like except to look at the last 4 years and keep the focus on the negative elements of that, particularly on the economy.
Again, Ron Elving with us from Washington, senior Washington editor for NPR News, and Lisa Lehrer is a reporter for Bloomberg News with us from New York City. As Mark Shields was talking last night, Lisa, and saying there was really not enough warmth, humor, or humility to go around from both candidates, and both were at least expected in this town hall format to show empathy and to show their more human side. Did you think that came through to any degree or any reasonable degree, convincing undecided voters?
Well, the tone on the debate was actually quite unusual because you saw the two candidates sort of go back and forth between trying to connect with the voters who are asking questions, looking at them, talking about their own personal stories. President Barack Obama, as he tends to do, mentioned the fact that he was raised by a single mother, and Mitt Romney, as he tends to do, mentioned the fact that his father was born in Mexico as a way of connecting with the audience. At the same time, this was a very aggressive, very sort of angry tone debate. At one point, the candidates were circling each other. The audience in the room gasped at one point when Romney told the president he wanted to finish his answer. I mean, you definitely got the sense that these were two men who just do not like each other all that much, and that came out strong. So you saw this unusual balance between trying to connect and be a bit softer with the voters and the people, the audience in the room, and also this really just very strong, rancorous tone towards each other.
Do you think that the needle moved at all or changed the race at all?
You know, I have to say that I agree with Ron on this. I'm going to give it to Obama, but really by a hair, and mostly because he, as Ron was saying, had to come back from his lackluster performance in the first debate. But Romney aides were not unhappy with his performance. The governor had a couple strong moments. One of them was when he rattled off a series of economic indicators that had worsened during the past 4 years, and then coupled that with promises that the president made when he ran for office 4 years ago that he hasn't come through on, like passing comprehensive immigration legislation. Republicans and Romney aides felt that that was a very, very strong moment for their candidate and something that will resonate not only in a way that will rally their base, you know, the folks that they need to turn out in force, but also really connect with independent and swing voters in battleground states who are, you know, still worried about the economy and haven't seen things improve all that much for them.
Well, when Governor Romney said that President Obama never introduced legislation that had to do with immigration, he probably, certainly hit some undecided voters. In fact, let's hear a cut of Governor Romney.
He said that he put in place in his first year a piece of legislation. He'd file a bill in his first year that would reform our immigration system, protect legal immigration, stop illegal immigration. He didn't do it. He had a Democrat House and Democrat Senate, supermajority in both houses. Why did he fail to even promote legislation that would have provided an answer for those that want to come here legally and for those that are here illegally today? That's a question I think the president will have a chance to answer right now.
Good. I look forward to it.
Well, I don't know that the president got the opportunity to answer, but with that and with talking about promises to cut the deficit and the trillions that have gone on, Lisa Lehrer, I guess from the Romney camp, this all looks very good because the president has essentially made out economics and immigration not to have followed through or fulfilled his promises.
Yeah, I mean, Romney advisors felt that they got the main message of their campaign across, which is, of course, you know, asking voters, are you better than you were 4 years ago? And one thing that really struck me about this debate is I think the arguments on both sides were really crystallized in a way that may have not been quite as clear during the first debate. You know, Romney got that message across, which really is the unifying theme of his campaign. And at the same time, the president got some of his major themes across. He used the opportunity to paint Governor Romney as an extremist who's on social issues, who's indebted to sort of the Tea Party wing of his party, something that the Democrats feel won't necessarily appeal to independents and swing voters. And he also used the opportunity to question the math and sort of the details of Romney's plan, various tax plans and other proposals, painting him as someone who isn't really giving all the information about what he would do to the American public. And that's something that his campaign has been hitting very, very hard for months and months.
Let's go to Larry Gersten, professor of the Department of Political Science at San Jose State. And Larry Gersten, want to get your take on this, but, you know, we sit in our perches here in our worlds of journalism or academia, and it's hard to know what the American people particularly are responding to or what is most important to them or makes most headway with them. But what do you think?
Well, that's what struck me most of all. Each of these candidates, I think, appealed to the base and did so fairly well. I mean, and that's very important to rally the base. Right now, the Republican base has seemed to be a bit more enthusiastic. No doubt last night brought a Democratic base up to par, I would think, given the president's performance. Almost anything he did last night would be better than 2 weeks earlier, and he certainly exceeded a lot of expectations on that count. The question is, what happens with the independents? What happens with the people who are undecided? Everybody's asking that question. And I'm not so sure that anything was cleared up last night. We look to the future. We all know what's happened. You can criticize it. You can defend it, whatever. But the question is, where do we go forward? And in each case, it seems to me, the candidates have failed to this point to still indicate how we will proceed. In the case of President Obama, very little was said other than, I'm going to keep trying to move this country forward. I'm going to try to get the Congress to go along with the things they haven't done. Kind of vague. In Romney's case, he's got a 5-point plan, 12 million jobs. The president hammered on him, as others have. Well, what do you mean by that? And to that end, exactly what kinds of exemptions, deductions, whatever, are you going to cut out in order to balance the budget? That has never come out. So in both cases, the candidates have been very, very fuzzy about where we're going from this point. And I think until that question's answered, the folks who are undecided are going to remain that way.
All right, let's in fact hear a cut from last night.
Of course they add up. I was someone who ran businesses for 25 years and balanced the budget. I ran the Olympics and balanced the budget. I ran the state of Massachusetts as a governor, to the extent any governor does, and balanced the budget all 4 years. When we're talking about math that doesn't add up, how about $4 trillion of deficits over the last 4 years? $5 trillion. That's math that doesn't add up.
Well, that was, of course, Governor Romney defending his record. But the fact is, Larry Gersten, that President Obama made a lot of points on the fact that that record, well, doesn't stand up to scrutiny in terms of its consistency.
I'm reminded of that Wendy's commercial during the Reagan-Mondale election years ago, where this woman in the commercial says, "Where's the beef?" And that's, of course, what Mondale said to Reagan, in his case, of course, to no avail. Well, where is the beef? In other words, exactly what kinds of cuts are you going to make? What kinds of changes are you going to make to balance that budget? That was the question the president asked again and again, and trust me, is just not enough. On the other hand, let's remember this. The president himself did not outline in any clear sense where he's going to take the country beyond, I'm going to do better the best I can, just trust me to move forward. So both candidates, I think, are lacking in this area, and until we get some specificity on how they intend to move this country forward, I think the folks on the sidelines, the folks who are undecided, the folks who will make the difference in the end, particularly in those swing states, are still going to remain that way.
Well, let me go back to Ron Elving on what has gotten certainly a great deal of discussion in terms of last night's debate, perhaps more than any of the domestic issues, and that was what happened in Libya and Benghazi specifically, and the whole question of semantics about whether the president called it a terrorist act or not a terrorist act. Who do you think looked better to undecideds on that, Ron?
This was a great opportunity for Mitt Romney that to some degree was squandered because of his focus on whether or not the president had used the word terror in his Rose Garden appearance the day after the attack. Now, Romney had brought it up and said that the president ran off to campaign the day after. And, of course, the president did campaign the day after and the day after that. But he did first have this Rose Garden event where he did use the word terror. He did not say, this in Benghazi last night was clearly a terrorist attack. He said, we will respond to any act of terror, leaving open the possibility that it might be one or the other. If you go back and look at the transcript, I think that's the fairest reading, that he was suggesting it might be and it might not. Of course, then the ambassador to the United Nations for the United States, Susan Rice, was on television saying that she thought that it had grown out of one of these spontaneous riots in response to that offensive video. And certainly there had been many such riots around the Arab world, around the Muslim world. But in this particular case, we now know, and the State Department has said repeatedly, this was not one of those cases, and it did not grow spontaneously out of one of those riots. It was a planned terrorist attack by some of the people that we would have had a better eye on in Benghazi, and especially when Ambassador Chris Stevens was in town. So it is all a painful episode of intelligence failure and of insufficient security, and it is an embarrassment to the administration, and it has been driven home as such for weeks now by members of Congress and certainly by the Romney campaign, and it was a clear opportunity to draw blood in this debate, but it was flubbed to a degree by the candidate, Mitt Romney, choosing to focus on whether or not the president had used the word terror in the Rose Garden on the day after the attack, and then having to bite down on the bitter pill that, in fact, the president had used that word, and moderator Candy Crowley from CNN said so, and that that prompted some response from the audience that was there watching the debate.
Well, the president did say, Mitt Romney did say that the president had gone to Las Vegas campaigning around that time. And the fact of the matter is that Mitt Romney got particularly contentious at that point with Candy Crowley. I wonder what kind of a job you think she did. Her hands were tied by the format initially, but she wouldn't sign on to just being a moderator. She wanted to be a journalist, and she played that role there.
Yes, she did. And I believe that was the proper role for her to play. And I believe that if the commission that puts on these presidential debates wants to have the credibility that is lent by journalists of some repute, they should stand behind them and say, we want you to act as a journalist and not simply as a conduit for questions. Initially, there had been some objection to having Candy Crowley have the power, as she did have in this format, to follow up or to comment or to be, as someone said, a first line of accountability. And in this case, she felt it incumbent on her to do so, and she did, and that blunted what was otherwise a sharp point that the governor was making. Now, of course, the governor is trying, too, to come back from the characterization of his own initial response to what was going on in Benghazi before we even knew that the ambassador had been killed there. He was out there politicizing the event. And normally, over the years, back over generations, one has had a little bit more deference from the major candidates in a moment such as this, stepping back, saying, well, let's not criticize until we have all the facts. In this particular case, in the midst of kind of a tough week for the Romney campaign, he and his folks had jumped on this pretty hard, pretty early, and they took a black eye for that.
On the day before, Secretary Clinton had kind of taken the heat away from President Obama. Let's actually hear this exchange from last night's debate.
I think it's interesting. The president just said something, which is that on the day after the attack, he went to the Rose Garden and said that this was an act of terror. You said in the Rose Garden, the day after the attack, it was an act of terror. It was not a spontaneous demonstration. Is that what you're saying?
Please proceed, Governor.
I want to make sure we get that for the record, because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror.
Get the transcript.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of terror.
Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
He did call it an act of terror. It did as well take 2 weeks or so for the whole idea of there being a riot out there about this tape to come out. You're correct about that.
Well, that's the cut from last night that we were talking about. And here, Lisa Lehrer is a new role for, well, a woman journalist and taking a central role. And at one point, the president steered the conversation toward the role of women. We had Governor Romney talking about binders full of women. In fact, let's hear the cut and get your response, Lisa Lehrer.
And I went to my staff and I said, how come all the people for these jobs are all men? They said, well, these are the people that have the qualifications. And I said, well, gosh, can't we find some women that are also qualified? And so we took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
Well, Lisa Lehrer, your take on that?
Well, binders full of women is probably not the way that Governor Romney wanted to phrase that.
Not elegant phrasing, no.
Yeah, definitely an elegant phrasing, something that he's been known to do throughout his campaign as someone who's followed him for quite a while. But actually the story today, you know, that phrase is blown up on Twitter, on the internet. People are making all kinds of binders of all kinds of different things, jokes all over the web. But the larger problem with that story for Governor Romney is it has been discredited. It turns out, according to reporting by some of the Boston news organizations, that the binder of women was actually produced by a women's organization in the state, and that the overall percentage of women in high levels of government for the state declined over his term in office, so that the statistics don't really bear out the story there. But the larger point, the larger thing that Governor Romney was trying to achieve there was he was trying to woo women voters. He's had some success doing that. At the beginning of the campaign, there was a huge, huge gap, something like close to 20 points, where women were favoring the president over Governor Romney. That's narrowed somewhat as the race has tightened, and you've seen his campaign really just do do a tremendous amount of outreach to women voters. They're out with a new campaign, a new ad actually today that features a woman saying that she looked into his views on abortion. You know, she had heard that Governor Romney would ban all abortion and contraception. He looked into it, and she says it turns out he doesn't oppose contraception at all. In fact, he thinks it should be an abortion should be an option in case of rape, incest, or to save a mother's life. So he's really trying to moderate his position on abortion and make sure that female voters understand where he is on that issue. And certainly he's trying to draw a big red line between his campaign and that of some of the more right-wing positions that some Senate candidates like Aiken and others have taken across the country on this issue.
And Lisa Lehrer, again, reporter for Bloomberg News, is with us from New York City. And by the way, you could be with us. In fact, we invite you to call with your thoughts about last night's debate. We'd like to hear your responses and impressions and any questions you might have. Our toll-free number is available, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page or our website. And our website is simply kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And Steve writes from our webpage, leaving the 47% comment to the end with no possibility of recourse from Romney was masterful. Let's hear the cut and hear from Larry Gersten on it.
But I also believe that when he said behind closed doors that 47% of the country considered themselves victims who refused personal responsibility, think about who he was talking about. Folks on Social Security who've worked all their lives. Veterans who've sacrificed for this country. Students who are out there trying to hopefully advance their own dreams, but also this country's dreams. Soldiers who are overseas fighting for us right now. People who are working hard every day.
Well, what was omitted in Denver, Professor Gersten, came at a crucial time, I suppose. It was masterful by many lights.
It was a stroke of luck in some ways, because you have to believe that the president wanted to get that out at some point during those 90 minutes, and the opportunity never presented itself until Mitt Romney handed it to him on a silver platter. That's the point when Romney was speaking, saying he cares about 100% of all Americans, everybody I care about, and he went on from there. Well, that set it up for the president. Oh, really? Do you care for 100%? Do you care for all Americans? What about the 47%? The president was very careful to say behind closed doors, indicating kind of a sinister effect here. It was masterful, but I'll tell you, if it wasn't for Mitt Romney setting it up, you kind of wonder whether the president would have had the opportunity to get that thing at all together.
Larry, I wonder what your response is to this is an email from a listener named Max who says, I'm curious if any of the guests have qualms centering debate analysis so much around body language and tone of voice. Have we taken up a dangerous habit of treating these debates like spectator sports, doing play-by-play? Doesn't this lead us astray from the original intent of debates to test and challenge ideas? There are these things called the issues. They matter.
Well, you're absolutely right. Look, when we look at a debate and you're seeing something on television, you've got style, you've got substance. And substance, of course, is very important. But the fact of the matter is, like it or not, right or wrong, people are swayed by style sometimes as much or in some cases more than substance. So you look at their body language. You look at the way they address each other. You look at the courtesies or lack thereof. You look at the interaction with the anchor, in this case, Candy Crowley. All of these things begin to weigh on people along with the substance. It may not be right, but it is the way the game is played these days.
And Larry Gersten, again, is professor of political science at San Jose State. When we return, we'll hear more from you, our listeners. President Barack Obama and challenger Mitt Romney meeting in their second 2012 presidential campaign last night in New York, having in-depth analysis and getting listener response. Email us, forum@kqed.org, go to our Facebook page, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and our website is kqed.org/forum. You can post questions or comments there. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about last night's debate, the second of three presidential debates between President Barack Obama and challenger former Governor Mitt Romney. And we have veteran analysts with us, political analysts. Ron Elving, of course, senior Washington editor for NPR News. Lisa Lehrer, reporter for Bloomberg News and with the Romney campaign, and with it meaning covering it. And Larry Gersten is with us as well, professor in the Department of Political Science at San Jose State University. And, of course, we're getting your reactions to the debate and any questions or comments you have. And one of the big questions is what kind of impact it has, particularly on undecided voters. Aren't that many of them still left? But did it move the needle? We also asked on our social media what people's thoughts were on the town hall format and Candy Crowley's performance as moderator, and you may want to weigh in there as well. Misha writes, the town hall format made me kind of nervous at some points in the debate. I was worried that it could quickly turn into a dogfight. Some said that perhaps it did. Another listener writes, the moderator was ineffective. They should have flashed questions on a screen and let the candidates self-time their answers. The moderator's job was not to back up the president, especially when she had no idea about the contents of his Rose Garden speech. Well, you may want to weigh in here as well, as I said, and any questions or comments are welcome. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum at kqed.org. You can also, of course, post any questions or comments you have on our Facebook page, and go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, and let's go to your calls. And we begin, Amy, with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Speak to us. Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm calling from San Francisco, and I just want to support your person who emailed in. I'm also interested in the facts much more than the style, and I wish that we could focus a little bit more on that in all of the analysis. One of the points that I think is likely to backfire on Governor Romney is he keeps asking, you know, how are things compared to 4 years ago? And I know what was happening exactly 4 years ago, and I think the American people know what was happening 4 years ago. Obama was not president, and the economy was going down the tubes. And I certainly thought we were headed for a huge depression, and so if you read the newspapers, did almost everybody. So, you know, I think Obama's answer, and he should give it more forcefully, is this is what I've done, this is how we've crawled out of this hole, and this is what I'm going to keep doing, as opposed to Romney's plans, which, as much as we can detect what they are, seem to be to do what we were doing 4 years ago.
Well, they mixed it up over what the bankruptcy was vis-a-vis Detroit and the auto industry, and they had completely different takes on that. But at one point, I was struck, Larry Gersten, with the fact that President Obama was asked a question by one of the members of the audience about really how he could distinguish himself from President Bush, and he did.
Yeah, you mean Romney distinguished himself from President
Bush.
I'm
sorry, Governor Romney distinguished himself from President Bush, exactly.
I think he did. I think he tried the best he possibly could to suggest the times are different. Look, we're more energy independent now. We're doing things that President Bush couldn't do. He said it actually in a fairly complimentary way so that he didn't undermine President Bush. On the other hand, Obama came back and he said, you know what, he is different from President Bush, but in a worse way. So I think they had a good exchange there. How deep it was, I'm not so sure. Look, when you talk about the economy, yes, it was a mess. It was terrible. And Romney tends to give Obama some room on this. He said the president inherited a mess. It was terrible. It wasn't his doing. The question I'm asking, Romney would say, is what has he done to get us out of it? And then Romney goes into the litany of statistics. And I think that's fairly powerful. Frankly, I think the more that Romney stays with that message, the better he's going to do. But when you get off on other topics, even Benghazi, it takes away from the opportunity for Romney to challenge the president on the most important topic to most Americans on any given day, and that is the economy.
Well, it also, Lisa Lehrer, I was struck by the differences that were so apparent with respect to China and not only trade with China, but also who had more Chinese investments in their pension plan. In fact, this was a rather amusing moment in some ways to many. Let's hear this.
Mr. President, have you looked at your pension?
You know, I don't look at my pension. It's not as big as yours, so it doesn't take as long.
Let me give you some.
You could say, Lisa Lehrer, that the president scored some points there. But with respect to China, it was almost as if they were embattled in saying who was going to be tougher where China's concerned.
Right. That moment was a moment that the president had been waiting for. His advisors had been saying since even before the first campaign that they were looking for a moment where he could subtly remind voters of Governor Romney's wealth as a way of, you know, pointing out how disconnected his personal experience is from the experience of average Americans who are struggling in this economy. But on the China front, it's true, much of this campaign has evolved into a battle on who can be harsher and tougher on China. And you see them, you see the two candidates battle over that issue all the time. Who's put the strongest, who, you know, Governor Romney says that he would do more in terms of trade tariffs. He's promised to label China a currency manipulator on the his first day in office. The president has touted his record, the things that he's done to hit back on China, tariffs he's put on tire imports, things like that. But this is really about, honestly, voters in the Midwest, and particularly voters in Ohio specifically. Ohio could very well determine the outcome of this election. And as everyone knows, a lot of jobs in that manufacturing state have been shipped overseas to China. So that's an issue that you see flare up, particularly when the candidates are traveling there. And as they are quite often traveling there, it comes up quite a bit.
Well, Ohio is crucial. And Ron Elving, I was struck by when they were talking about coal, President Obama brought up, and it's been in Democratic commercials, a picture of Mitt Romney when he was governor of Massachusetts, not exactly being a friend to coal miners.
This has been another theme for the Obama campaign, and one that they have not had nearly as much success with as one might have thought, or they might have thought. Mitt Romney, the flip-flopper. We heard in the course of this debate about Mitt Romney's current position with respect to weapons and AK-47s and weapons control, and that was quite different from what he did when he was governor of Massachusetts, and also about this coal-fired plant that he called a killer. He said that this plant was actually a killer, and he was closing it down and taking a lot of credit for that. It was a coal-fired plant. Now he says that any effort to restrict the use of coal in the country is anti-jobs, anti-coal, anti-energy. So this was an interesting part of the debate. They engaged in it for quite a long time at the beginning of the debate, and they talked about whether or not the number of leases had risen or fallen on federal lands and whether or not there was more or less production from the United States and whether that was from private or federal lands, the kind of thing that tends to lose viewership when you're up against, say, baseball playoffs and things of that nature on the tube, but the kind of thing that really is important ultimately to judging which of these two programs would ultimately lead to more job creation and more energy production in the United States. That is a crucial part of putting the entire economy back on a growth footing. And I think both the candidates believe that they're willing to do the right parts of that. Barack Obama would like to put more emphasis on renewables, less emphasis on the fossil fuels. But right now, for Mitt Romney, the votes are in a different place from where they were in Massachusetts. There aren't so many coal votes in Massachusetts, although there are some. And now, of course, the votes from southern Ohio and parts of Pennsylvania they'd like to be contesting are very important. And we have seen a rebirth of Mitt Romney on this issue of coal.
And we'll go to more of our callers. Leo, join us. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if anyone on your panel had caught that last night. Mitt Romney gave another glimpse of the amount of deductions that he's going to allow for people to make up the difference of his 20% tax decrease. He said, let me pull a number, $25,000, that you have a bucket of deductions that you can, you know, put in whatever you want to put into that bucket. That's up to you. But then he later on brought it up again, saying, Mr. President, I gave you a number. I gave you a number that you and the American people can use. And he didn't directly say that $25,000, but I believe that's the second or third time that the idea of a bucket of deductions has come up. And I want to say that in a previous debate, that number was $17,000. So I thought it was interesting that the number had changed, but also that he had given a glimpse of, you know, a solid number that he would allow deductions to make up for his tax.
Did you pick up on that, Ron Elving?
I don't get the exact way that that would work, and I don't see how that begins to provide enough money to pay for the full reduction in rates, not only corporate rates but individual rates, 20% across the board. That is the feature that Mitt Romney says will reignite the economy. At some point or another, one of two things has to happen. Either the deficit has to get greater because you're bringing in less revenue, or you have to make up the revenue by taxing someone somehow. Mitt Romney says he will will keep the percentage being paid by the top percentages of incomes at 60%. That 5%, I believe, of the taxpayers would continue to pay 60% of the overall taxes. That is pretty close to exactly the language that George W. Bush used to sell his tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, which wound up being big tax cuts for the wealthy and which also wound up adding trillions of dollars to the deficit in the years from 2001 to 2009.
Well, as is always the case with presidential debates or any major debates, there are listeners, those of you who are listeners to this program, who weigh in on things you think should have been discussed and were disappointed weren't discussed. I just want to read a few emails to give a flavor of that. Art writes, "The public failed completely last night in my book. Where has there been one word in this entire campaign about the environmental and sustainability questions? How hot does it have to get before these numbskulls address what is perhaps the most important issue before the human race?" And Mark writes, "How can we have come this far in an election year and not have heard these guys debate the fact that Mitt Romney has said he would overturn Roe v. Wade? Next week's debate is supposed to focus on foreign policy, and I fear that Romney will not be taken to task on such a landmark issue. And with two Supreme Court seats likely becoming available, it's unbelievable to me that this important issue hasn't formally surfaced in these debates. Are we really willing to allow this landmark legislation to be undone by the Republican Party without so much as a discussion?" Lisa Lair?
Well, I was actually somewhat surprised by the number of issues that did come up. We saw several gun control. That's something that's come up a little bit on the campaign, but got a whole question and two long responses during this debate. And the question was basically, how would you limit the use of assault rifles? What kind of limitations would you put on? That's not a question that the vice presidential candidates were likely to get in Kentucky, so that was a bit of regional influence, I think, based on the fact that the debate was held in Long Island. Immigration came up. Women's issues came up, not just abortion, but also various equal pay laws and things like that. So I thought we did get a pretty nice variety of issues in this debate, given that it is only 90 minutes. And the next debate, of course, as the caller mentioned, is going to be focused on foreign policy. So I think that debate will hear an awful lot about, a lot more about Libya. It's something that Romney aides think that although they acknowledge that their candidate did not handle the question in the exchange with Candy Crowley and Obama as well as they hoped that he would have, he got a little bit, as we were saying before, hung up on the semantics, they still see that as an issue where they can gain ground. The president has had a really strong record on foreign policy and had really high approval ratings. He, of course, has ended the war in Iraq. He helped capture and kill Osama bin Laden. So those are things that have really boosted his approval in that area and taken what's been a traditionally Republican strength and turned it into something that's really benefited, in this case, the Democratic candidate. Since the attack on the U.S. mission in Libya, though, you've seen those numbers come down a little bit. So it's an area where Romney aides think they can pick off a little bit of support from the president, and they think they're trying to connect it to their larger economic message, saying, you know, you have to keep America strong abroad to, you know, keep America strong at home and things like that. So they're trying to sort of tie into their larger economic themes.
I was wondering, though, also, as some listeners are, about the social issues, Larry Gersten. Nobody mentioned gay marriage, for example.
Nobody mentioned gay marriage, and I was struck too that this question of women's right to choose did not get more attention. It just strikes me the Roe versus Wade issue is one that's come up again and again. Governor Romney has taken different positions on this issue at different points, not only in his political career but during his campaign. And if, in fact, the women's vote, particularly the suburban women's vote, is the vote that everyone thinks is important, that along with the discussion of the auto industry, it seems to me, are the two most important issues that could sway the outcome of the vote in those swing states such as Ohio. And I don't understand why the president didn't at some point pursue this, because I think that would have been a rich opportunity.
Well, I want to actually get your response to a tweet that I'm looking at, Larry, but also there's a listener who writes on our Facebook page, "I found Governor Romney's response on equal pay for women incredibly offensive. Hiring some women does nothing to address inequality, and while flexible schedules are helpful, framing it about women going home in time to cook dinner is unacceptable." And here's a tweet from Adriana who tweets, "I read truly undecided voters are mostly white working class females without a college degree. What a poll say this Focus Group thought of the debates. Do you get any light on that, Larry Gersten?
I think those are good observations. I mean, you know, you have to remember who is going to vote and who's not. Now, there's no question about it that people with high school educations are not going to vote as much a degree as those with college educations, but still, this is a mass of people. And when you're looking, really, we're talking about 7 or 8 states, and we're talking about 200,000-300,000 voters in those states. And then you mine it further, and you're talking maybe about 80,000 or 90,000 women in those states out of the 150 million people who are going to cast a vote one way or the other. Well, you've got to get very specific at this point, 3 weeks out. You've got to let these people know where you stand on these issues. And I'm not so sure that the Obama team last night took advantage of that.
Ron Elving, what about advantage from either of the two teams with respect to, I suppose one could always argue that abortion and gun control, we used to call talk show 101 for both, but they also do affect a lot of people's thinking and consciousness in terms of their exercising their franchise. Assault weapons came up, Fast and Furious came up. Who do you think really made the most impression on undecideds?
With respect to gun control, this is not an issue that Democrats particularly want to talk about because so many Democrats feel so strongly in opposite directions on this one. You've got a lot of people in big cities who simply do not understand why the NRA, the National Rifle Association, is in a position to simply write bills in so many legislatures around the country and have those bills passed more or less the way they're written by the NRA. They do not understand the degree to which this has been taken off the table in the federal legislature because of losses suffered by the Democrats in the election of 2000, Al Gore's defeat, and of course in the 2002-2004 Republican wins in terms of Congress, and even all the way back to 1994 when they first took over control of Congress after 40 years in the wilderness in the House. These people are afraid of the gun issue because the Democratic Party splits on it and it hurts them, particularly in states they desperately need, like Ohio and like Western Pennsylvania. So this is an issue that really the president's going to try to segue over into talking about violence. He's going to say it'd be nice to have an assault weapons ban. It's not going to happen in this Congress. And with respect to Fast and Furious, this is a complete distraction, really, from the basic issue of gun control in the United States, except that, again, gun advocates, Second Amendment advocates, the NRA believes that Fast and Furious and these guns that were released into criminal hands in Mexico was actually an attempt to create such a huge backlash against the violence of those guns so as to somehow make Americans all want to have more gun control in the United States. That is actually the position that many people who are pushing the Fast and Furious investigation have taken. So I'm surprised that that came up when so many other things didn't come up or did not get nearly as much discussion as they deserved, and why the president didn't bring up Roe versus Wade and those, and he did mention the Supreme Court appointment power, but why didn't make it more explicit to Roe versus Wade, a woman's right to choose, is a mystery.
Ron Elving, senior Washington editor, NPR News, and Charles is joining us as our next caller. Charles, you're on.
Yeah, good morning. I'm here in San Francisco. I'm a registered Republican, and you know, after watching the debate last night, I felt that Governor Romney was too much in the realm of the nitpicking and just really trying to pick at Obama for this and that and, you know, the tragedy that happened with our ambassador, and that President Obama was more of substance, talking about his accomplishments and his plans for the next 4 years. I think Romney, you know, toward the end of the debate, he turned his back and walked back toward his chair, and he looked a little defeated. And I'll say, President Obama, today I'm going to send in my absentee ballot, and he's got my vote.
All right, we thank you for that, Lisa Lehrer.
Well, I don't think that that's going to make the Romney campaign very happy, but I think the caller illustrates why body language and why those kinds of things are so important. You know, voters take away a general impression of the candidates from this. It's not just what they're saying. It's how they're acting. It's how they're treating the other, you know, their opponent. And Governor Romney had a bit of a tough situation here. He knew the president was going to come on very aggressive, and he had to be respectful of the office while also trying to find ways to undermine his record and, you know, give a clear sense of what his vision for the country would be. I guess he didn't do it well enough for that caller, but in many ways, I think what the caller said was picking on the president really rallies the base. And that's part of what this election is about. A big part of what this election is about for the Romney team is they really need to make sure that their party comes out in force.
Well, when he said to President Obama, I mean, after all, this is the president of the United States. They may not like each other. He may be the opposing candidate, but one respects the office, presumably. And he says, you'll get your chance. It's almost as if he was talking to a menial or something.
Right, but you know, at the same time, he has to show that he can stand up to the commander in chief, that he can be presidential, and so part of that is challenging the president. That's the structure of the debate, and frankly, the base loves that. You know, a lot of people in the Republican base really don't like Obama. They have very, very strong feelings against the president, and they want to see Romney stand up there and go toe to toe with him, and that's really important for the Romney campaign. They have to make sure that, you know, these Republicans in Southwest Ohio, places like that, are coming out in very, very strong margins like they did for President Bush in 2004, and that really helped President Bush win that race.
And we're getting more listeners complaining about perhaps what comes under the general rubric of lack of substance. Larry Gersten, let me give you a sense of this. Sherry writes, that was not a debate. Answers were pretty much off topic, and other eligible candidates, Green, are arrested because they want a debate. What a disgraceful situation. We call this a democracy. Obama continually fails to say what he has in mind for a second 4 years. Candy was a bit more forceful, but basically inept. She was a heck of a lot better than Lehrer. Another listener, David, says, I have to disagree with your talking head. I listen to these debates looking for facts, answer to my questions. But the next day, when listening to your talking heads, all they seem interested in is fashion, how they look. If you all you need to feed a horse is hay, that's all it'll eat. Force these politicians to tell the truth, to answer questions, not to lie instead of catering to the game the press allows them to play. Shame on the press for letting down the people again. Joseph writes, I'm still uncertain what the objective is with the debate format. We're already so overwhelmed with clever rhetoric that feeds on the inability, of the average mind to discern any truth. Is it all about who wins? On the facts? Apparently not. On the strength of character in the cauldron of the stage? Maybe. Without a clear objective, we're left with only assessing their character so we can decide whom we trust more. Larry Gersten, I think a lot of this kind of aggregates or adds up to the fact that there's cynicism about the whole debate process and about what it serves and about people looking largely on images and style rather than substance and facts.
Well, there's no question. We're never going to satisfy everyone, I think ourselves included, when it comes to what should be done, what should be said, and all of the other things around that. That's just what we have to live with. So I'm not going to defend the process as being perfect. Far from it. I do want to point out, however, that I thought Candy Crowley last night did a fabulous job. And why? Because she did her best to hold them accountable. She exercised the follow-up. And that's the kind of thing that gets away. Yes, every candidate comes up with a standard answer. They're prepared. They know what's coming, generally speaking. They give an answer they want to give. But the follow-up forces the candidate to get out of the box. The follow-up forces the candidate to go beyond. And then the viewer can say, well, you know what? That person never did answer it, never did, or did a better job. But at least that gives us the opportunity to see what that individual can do. One other point, character counts. Character is a big part of the person we elect to be president of the United States. It's not only the way that person manages facts. It's the way that person expresses himself. It's what he's all about. It's his values. And I think we saw a lot of that come out from both of these candidates last night. You begin to understand not only data, you begin to understand who they are, what they value, and how they tend to look at the world.
And we certainly saw sharp differences in how they look at the world last night. Andrew is our next caller. Andrew, joining us from New York. Welcome.
Yes, good afternoon. I wanted to ask your panel whether they thought the United States has lost the respect of the world in a sense, because this is supposed to have a certain minimum of decorum when you're dealing with the president's office, and it has really been relegated to almost like a street fight where both candidates have to be jumping up and down trying to point out their point, and there's no sense of decorum that, you know, this is a respected office, and that was really clear yesterday, and I found it's just abhorrent.
Well, I think we're going to do a program perhaps as early as Monday of next week with some foreign journalists letting us know how they view the presidential, well, not only the debates, but the whole campaign process. But you want to weigh in here, Ron Elving?
My guess would be that many people around the world would be surprised to see the level of dignity that the candidates had in either direction, depending on what they were used to in their own country. I can certainly imagine many countries in which a debate between the candidates would not be possible unless you were able to disarm everyone in the immediate vicinity. I can also imagine countries where perhaps they were able to reach a higher level of intellectual engagement and a higher level of respect for each other. And I think we have done that at some points in our past. But television is a great leveler. Television is something that plays to the maximum audience, and it tends to some degree to play to the lowest common denominator. It includes all of us, but to some degree in its attempts to reach all of us, it takes things out to the broadest possible perspective. So I've seen some debates among European leaders that I don't think would be anything to be proud of either.
I wonder, Larry Gerson, what you would say to listener Dan, who writes online, why are we fixated on a tiny sliver of undecided voters? It seems both sides have much greater chances of swaying outcome by focusing on motivating their base.
By this time in the election, most people have made up their mind. Depending upon the survey, somewhere between 5 and 10% are still on the fence. A lot of this has to do with the fact that most of us have predispositions in advance, and those of us who are a little uncertain tend to solidify those predispositions as we get closer. Now we're really looking at the very few who just don't know which direction they're going to go. And it all gets to, it gets to things like turnout. It gets to things like what issues are getting to people at the last moment. And for these people, these debates are the most important thing of all. There are also people who are tuning in late. So the images they see, the answers that they hear, are going to maybe have a disproportionate effect. And the candidates are counting on that. The candidates are counting on swaying these people, again, particularly in those swing states where the vote remains uncertain.
One more listener comment, and Lisa Lehrer, I'd like your response to this. This is Jim, who writes, I watched this debate and observed that the actual difference between these two people is very small. If you drop out the potshots and prevarications, you realize that voters who expect big government to improve their lives will vote one, and those who see personal responsibility and free enterprise as their important values will vote for the other.
Well, I mean, people vote on a lot of different issues, certainly social issues, as we were saying before on this program. Abortion can weigh very heavily for female voters. But I think there is a balancing act going on here. They are fighting for the small sliver, increasingly small sliver, of undecided voters. But at the same time, they really do have to motivate their bases. And you're seeing the Romney campaign and the Obama campaign. That was a big part of what they tried to do in this debate, and I think they both did it pretty successfully. The other thing that's worth mentioning is that then the dynamics this year are slightly different given early voting. A greater number of people are expected to vote.
That's going to have to end it, Lisa. I'm sorry. Lisa Lehrer from Bloomberg News, thank you. Ron Elving of NPR News, thank you. And Larry Gerson from San Jose State, thank you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.